Zion says Shibuna Ircha. Shibuna Ircha. Shibuna Ircha b'mehera of Yomeinu. We say in the Tilis here, some of the numbers are Shibuna based on Migdash Merit Yomeinu. The Seichel Cannabis Arasecha. And he said, Shibuna Ircha b'mehera of Yomeinu with Seichel Cannabis Arasecha. So why is he says Ircha and we say Shibuna based on Migdash? Which one? I can tell you right away why we say Shibuna based on Migdash. Why do we say she's bona based on Migdash Meremena? What's the Hebrew rushing to do? Because Tfilah is carbon. So therefore, we say that Tfilah is Makam carbon. We're saying in the Shalma Parnas for saying that even though the base of Migdash is gone, the carbon is not gone. Because we have another way of bringing carbonus. That's verbal. We bring verbal carbonus is just as good. You don't have the Migdash, so you have the verbal carbonus. But we hope to reinstate the original carbon. Which means to bring back the Migdash and the Kabbonis, because Tfilah is in place of Kabbonis. Okay, that makes sense. But over here, we have to understand why he says it's a Kabbonis. Okay?
Probably the sovereignty and no.
Where's the contradiction in the memo? There's a contradiction in this. Exactly. Right. That's it. First it says heavy as kanema, which means a person should be bold like a leopard. And then it says he said as panim legehenim, a person that's bold goes to Gehenna. So a person that's bold goes to Gehenna. So on the contrary, so what is the contradiction? So why is he
bold?
It depends what he's being bold in. Okay, I know, but it's not just coincidental that he has the same quality of boldness in two different frameworks.
Second one, see? Chutzpah negative.
Chutzpah negative.
Yeah.
The second one, chutzpah negative. See, it's an interesting memory. This memory, I think, stands out among the other members because of the fact that it is aiming at a very specific level. What if the ideas we received at Sinai were not just the Torah itself, but Torah and all embracing. In the Torah, philosophy, and psychology. I mentioned before that the godless Torah is the difference between Torah and between abstract philosophers who, in many respects, were incorrect. But the difference is that the Torah that was given, Torah was given to us by God, was given to us in a way that it moves a person on a lower level. No one's going to be moved by Aristotle's ethics unless they're on a certain level. But the Torah is given to us in a way that it moves a person on various levels. That's why the question they ask, they say, if the Torah is such a deep system of ethics, so why is it stories? Why did the Torah write, just like Aristotle wrote ethics, write down the ethical principles and whole system of ethics, just like the philosophers wrote? No. The Torah tells you the story of Avraham Avinu, story of Yaakov, his life struggle. Story of Yosef HaTzadik. Why is that so? Because the Torah knows that in order to reach a person, you must deal with the psychological, not just the philosophical. So the Torah portrays various individuals and shows you the struggles that they went through in their lives, because this is a beacon of light to a person. When a person is in a situation of the Sion, and he knows, just a second, there was somebody else that was in that same situation. And you study what went on in his mind, he's a model. This is something which moves an individual towards perfection. Abstract philosophy can't do it by itself. Abstract philosophy is very nice. But how do you bridge the gap between the reality of a person's emotions and the abstract idea in the philosophy? There's only one way. And that way is to show him another human being that went through that same struggle, that same difficulty, and he can identify with that individual and study and learn from that person's experiences. That's why the Torah sets up models and personalities. Maisevos. That says Maisevos, but not just Elos, you have the Dovra Melech, you have the Evanathim also. different individuals, shows you the struggle. It brings it down to reality. It brings it to a person's emotional level. That's the benefit of Torah. So that's one thing. And also that's the difference. That's the difference between Torah's approach and between philosophy. That's why you don't have any, you don't have a system of ethics. You have myselfs. The Torah also works in a way. It gives you an avos. It gives you psychology. It teaches you psychology. So a person should be aware of certain psychological mechanisms that he could use for his own benefit. Okay. And this Mishnah, I believe this Mishnah differs from every other Mishnah because of the fact, in a basic way, because it is aiming at a certain level of function that is beneath, below the ultimate level. But it's trying to reach a person on a lower level. Okay. Let's take the last part of the Mishnah first. The second part of the Mishnah first. Not the two of them. But Az Ponim L'Gehenna and Boshis Ponim L'Ganeidim. What does this mean? So the Rambam says already. The Rambam says that Chazal say that the Jews have certain traits. And the Gemara says, the Rambam says, that there are three traits in this nation. That's why Yasser didn't see them. He says, no, they forbade the Kharas Rachman to marry them, because they didn't have these traits. What are the traits? The traits are Rachmonim, Baishonim, and Gomer Chazal. Interesting. Rachmonim, it means that the compassionate people, the Jew has mercy, that's his nature. And he's also a Baishon, it means to say that he has shame, and he's not an Azponim, he doesn't have an arrogance and a boldness, but he has a certain kind of emotional integrity, a certain shamefulness, that if he does something wrong, he's actually ashamed. He has a certain wariness. He's not just bold. A certain wariness in his emotional makeup. And it means that if a Jew is shown to be wrong, he'll experience a greater pain than other people. On the whole. That's a new definition. By Shem. And Gomle Chasodim means that they're kind people. Gomle Chasodim really and Rachmanim are very close together. Closely tied. Because Rachmanim means they identify with other people. They feel compassion towards any person, towards any human being. Rachma v'kol masa. And that's why you're mefarnes on the Yakim too. Goyim that are poor, so it's a mitzvah to mefarnes them also. Support them, give them tzedakah. Get tosho. Empathy. Even animals, tzar balachayim, okay? But the tzar balachayim. But the, so rachma v'kol masa, which means it's a Kodesh Baruch Hu, which a Jew, because of the fact that he's Zera Avraham, and because of all the years of being committed to Torah, he has this emotional mechanism, rachma. And gomle chasad means that he's gemilas chesed, and he's not just compassionate, but he also is able to put his hand into his pocket and to give of himself financially and personally in terms of his time and his efforts in terms of chesed. He's gomle chesed. Okay? Because a person can be compassionate, identifies, and that's it. He walks away. It's a shame. It's terrible. But he walks away, and that's it. So Jew is more. Has more. The other, so really Rachamonim and Gomle Chasodim are one trait. It's just Gomle Chasodim is a further development of Rachamonim. And the other side you have Baishanus. What is Baishanus? Baishanus means that the person feels a sense of shame. And he doesn't have a certain type of arrogance. Yeah, Azas Mesa. What does it mean? It means like this. So I'll ask you a question, but the fact is that we know that the only value that there is in really doing mitzvahs is not based upon an emotional plane. Because all these emotions can get a person into trouble. A person is merachim and he's not supposed to be merachim, so it's wrong. If you're merachim on an Azov, Esther Amalka would have been merachim on Haman or Russia when he was begging and pleading for his life, then the worst catastrophe. So she's able to, it didn't affect her, and she had him destroyed. So you see, Rachmanis is not the answer. We don't believe in emotions. No emotional attitude could ever really lead a person to perfection. So on the one hand, we know that no emotional attitude can lead a person to perfection. On the other hand, we praise these emotions. And we say, you can't marry somebody that doesn't have these qualities. That was the issue on the Nesinim. How do you reconcile the two? How do you reconcile the two? What's the answer?
Maybe you have to have the capacity for this type of decency or kindness. You have to.
It's not in your makeup. It's not in a person's makeup. Then it's a tragedy. But it means it like this. It means that no emotion, there is no emotional attitude that you could use to guide you through life. That's the mistake of the guy in the world. Ethics, where they maintain that just there's such a thing as secular ethics. Secular ethics is nonsensical. Rationally, you can never understand it. It doesn't make any sense. There's no reason to be ethical. There's no reason in the world to be ethical. You can never show me a logical argument why I should be ethical. It doesn't exist. I could argue that, on the contrary, I just survive with the fittest. See, that's the way nature is, and that's the way I'll be. There's no way to argue it. It's only something that they try to use because it has an emotional appeal. But an emotional appeal, then you get into trouble. So which emotion should I follow? Which emotion shouldn't I follow? And let's say even the emotion that has appeal, when do I follow it? My child is begging me to let him go play in the street. Do I follow that emotion of kindness and rahmanas or not? So you see, obviously any intelligent person knows that there's no way that you could follow an emotion and reach any kind of perfection. But yet Yadda says that there are basically two emotions that it endorses. One of them is rahmanas, and one of them is Baishanas. Why is that so? Because what Yadis maintains is like this. That a person is emotional. You can't get away from it. A person's emotions is an integral part of his makeup. They're dangerous in terms of directing his life. But the Torah maintains that a certain kind of emotional attitude is good when you have a choice between various emotions. There are certain emotions which, on the whole, it is better for a person to partake of because they lead a person to perfection. One of them is. Yes.
Yeah, you get a very good illustration.
Like,
correct.
No, that's good. Yeah, that's right.
But not the emotions.
Because
it's not going to decide by the emotions.
Yes. The two emotions that are endorsed by Yadis is Baishanas and Rahmanas. Rahmanas, why? Because Rahmanas takes a person away from himself. Rahmanas takes a person away from himself. It gives him feeling towards an outside reality. So on a basic level, you must have that emotion. If you don't have that emotion, then the person is totally into himself, totally narcissistic, and it's impossible to perfect oneself. Because you cannot perfect yourself unless you get out of the emotion. Baishanas as well. What does Baishanas come from? Baishanas comes from the superego. It means that a person is a certain sense that she feels shame if he does something that's improper. If you take that emotion away, then the instincts will be rampant. That emotion of Baishanas is the counter to the instinctual. And the question is, where should a person be, in what situation should... You have to have an emotional plane, because a person functions on an emotional plane. So Yadda says he should function on the emotional plane of Baishanas. If he functions on that plane, that's, even though it's not rational, but it makes it possible for him to be rational. If he doesn't have the Baishanas, if he doesn't have that sense of dignity, that if he does something wrong, that he feels it's an indignation to his personality, he doesn't have that sense, then he could never really be perfected, because the instincts will take over. So therefore, the Torah endorses two emotions, Rahmanas and Baishanas. Of course, the Torah dictates that these emotions are just a platform from which to begin. And then his chokhmah has to be able to control all the emotions. But he must have an emotional makeup. That's a mark of a Jew. That's the mark of a Jew, to have those two meters. Rahmanas and Baishanas.
Yes. Baishanas seems to be universal too, in the sense when someone's Adam
sins. You say when a person's an Ote, the Rambam says. The Rambam's like this. Sheyesh lam boshes ponach. He says, וכן אמר שמוסה ואברהם שהם ביישון ורחמנו ודום לחסונם אמר ובעבור תהיה ירוסו על פניכם לבלתי שחתו ובעבור תהיה ירוסו על פניכם לבלתי שחתו means it's a personal shame it means that when דבר המלך saw that he was a chote and not an anavi explained it to him so then he felt a sense of shame he couldn't answer it so the only thing there was a blank space in the because he couldn't respond he felt totally ashamed how could he commit such a fate so the blank space there's a blank space in the
safe
where he says Tosu Hashem there's a blank space what's the blank space the blank space was he couldn't talk, couldn't speak he felt total shame when a person feels total shame he can't talk he can't move that's the sign of total shame he can't function ceases to function that's the space in the so what the Pasuk says is that this emotion is an emotion which a person has to have and which really helps a person which benefits a person but of course an emotion can't be the guide but that is the base the emotional base the correct emotional base that a person has to that is, a person's yadus has to be built up okay I'll stop there we'll continue
is that the idea
person who does something which is detrimental, harmful to himself, and yet he knows that it's no good. So this is the old philosophical question. The philosophers called it by referring to the term as the rape of the mind by the emotions. Is it possible for the emotions to coerce and subdue the mind and cause the person to act against knowledge? In other words, if I say that the only perfection of man is through knowledge, is it possible that an individual, for instance, is a drunkard and recognizes that his life is being destroyed? Is it possible for him to fall prey to the practice of getting drunk in spite of his knowledge? So on the surface, you say yes, because every drunkard realizes that he's ruining his life, yet he continues to do so. So this would seem to indicate that the mind is powerless in the face of the emotions. On the other hand, we do notice that before the person partakes of it, goes back to his bad habits, his mind, he will always tell himself that this case is different. This one time I need it. Which means that at the time he does it, he rationalizes, he thinks. His knowledge, he loses the previous knowledge that he has. And he can't just act. No human being can act totally against knowledge, against his mind. So then we might say the weakness is in terms of his ability to retain his knowledge. For some reason, he loses his knowledge. But the fact is that the only perfection for man is through knowledge. Although we have to admit that there is a phenomenon that can cause a person to lose his knowledge. Even according to the second way, the second way is just showing me that you can't act against mind. A person can never act against his mind, which is an important thing to know. But it also shows you that for some reason there can be a serious amnesia of knowledge. Now, what's the cause of this amnesia? So we're going to have to say the cause of this amnesia is something other, which we have to approach. Which means, again, that in order to attain perfection, it's not enough just to gain knowledge, but to be able to control the individual so that he doesn't lose this knowledge suddenly. All right? In which case, you're saying, again, that the emotions can overpower the mind. The only thing is, it's the method through which it overpowers the mind. What does it do? It doesn't overpower the mind directly. It simply causes the mind to suddenly become very ignorant. Okay? There is an interesting chazal by Yosef HaTzadik. Very interesting. Yosef HaTzadik, it says, Vayavo Abaisa Lasas Malachko. So chazal say that really he was giving in to the urge to live with Potiphar, right? He was giving in to the urge. Ace Potiphar. So what happened at the time? The Gemara says, and the Chazal say that he saw the Dmus Diyuk Noshel of it, right? And what was in this Dmuk? What did the Dmus Diyuk Noshel of it tell him? Told him that his name is not going to appear on the Choshen. Not going to appear on the Choshen. That stopped him. What's the shot? What does that have to do with his name? Like I said, the Choshen. So what it means is, what Chazal mean is like this, that in the, he was overpowered by the emotion of love, powerful emotion. And that emotion basically carries with it a very strong narcissistic satisfaction, that it makes the person feel very elated. That's the effect of the emotion. That's one of the forces involved, one of the psychological forces involved in romantic love, is that the person feels elated because of the acceptance of the other person. So what Chazal was saying is that he thought to himself that emotion, that force of acceptance, which is so powerful, really is causing me to forfeit a more powerful kind of recognition, which is the ultimate recognition in terms of having the person having his name on the ephod when he's on the ephod of the Kohen Gadol, and in the long result there's going to be a very great net loss. See? Once he realized that, he was able to refrain. It's an interesting, very interesting Chazal. What Chazal are saying is that Chazal are saying, really, I mean, it's advice. It's advice. And the truth of the matter is that the advice Chazal are giving is not dependent really upon the particular case of the ephod. You have to realize that. It means that in the ephod was the case by Yosef. But in every person's life there's an ephod. In other words, there's an ultimate, a person when he's involved in Avera, he's forfeiting for a momentary pleasure. The same thing he's looking for in the momentary is often attainable by foregoing the Avera on a grander scale in the future. So it doesn't have to be through the ephod, it could be through recognition of people, it could be through recognition in life. Like the Gemara says that Reuven said, the Chazal say that if Ilu Hayed, if Reuven would have known that the Torah would write about him, Vayatuleu Miadam, so he would have gone and taken Yosef on his, pulled him out of the bone of his shoulders and saved him. So then the Chazal say that every person's life is really nichtav. Every person has a Sefer Torah being written about him. It's the ultimate, it's the Sefer Torah of his life. So what are Chazal saying? Chazal is saying is that you can see it clearly in terms of the Torah, because that's an eternal text and everybody recognizes it. But the truth of the matter is that even though an ordinary person is not going to be described on that level, but the fact is that there is an ultimate kind of reality even in his personal life, that if he think into it, he'd say it's not worth it. What are people going to say? What are people going to say about me in the future? And it's not that it's not so much the recognition of people per se, but there's a difference between recognition of people per se, some recognition, which could be false, and a recognition of the truth. When a person has recognition, person is seeking for recognition from people. So a shallow person is just looking for the recognition. He doesn't care. Do anything that he wants. He'll pay off the people, and they'll make a big dinner in his honor. He doesn't care how he gets it, as long as he gets that fantasy. I'm not talking about that. That's a shallow person. But a person that wouldn't move a person on a deeper level that doesn't like this. As a matter of fact, he dislikes such a thing because he knows it's false. But there is in every person the recognition of the fact that a true recognition is valuable in the sense that it reflects a reality, and the power comes from the reality that it reflects. So what Chazal is saying is that every person, in the case of Yosef, really is not just Yosef Tzadik, it could be any person. Every person's name's not going to be in a choshen, but every person has his own choshen. Now, eventually, there's going to be a tremendous net loss. He's going to be involved in a situation for his own egoistic motives, but the net loss in terms of the true recognition that would happen from people later is going to be extremely great. So what is Chazal saying? It's a very interesting idea. Apparently, what saved Yosef wasn't philosophical knowledge. See, I mean, that's what Chazal saying. What saved him was a type of reasoning. It was reasoning that saved him. Without reasoning, he couldn't have made it. Reasoning saved him. But what kind of reasoning was it? It was a reasoning within the framework. What Chazal is saying is when a person is in the grips of the emotion, is like you said, Yitzhak Takfo, the person's in the grips of the emotion, he can't philosophize. His ability to philosophize is completely impaired. But within the framework of the emotion itself, if you can realize the fact that it's a net loss, that could save him. That's what Chazal is saying. It's an interesting thing. Within the framework that a person must see, he's in the grips of the emotion, but what is the emotion really after? It's after this. But that's just a moment. You're gonna need a slight amount of that, but look at what your loss is. If that's what you want, then you have to be a chacham and really go after it. So it uses the emotion itself, the force of the emotion, to prevent the person from falling into chet. That's what Chazal is saying by Yisra Tzadik. It would seem from the Torah that Vayavo Abaisa Lasos Malachto, it was too late. That was it. It was in the grips of the emotion. Too late for philosophizing.
But in other...
That's right. He was focusing on an emotion which was not in the frame of the reality, because he's not going to be there to enjoy it. But the fact remains that it reflected an ultimate recognition. An ultimate recognition, which a person can't just put away. A person can't put that away. That is true, he's not going to be there, but the fact is, the fact that that's an eternal recognition and that's an eternal entity, a person can't turn his mind away from it because he knows he's involved in an eternal concept. The Rambam's method was never to just take a chazal and say that settles the philosophical question. Okay, so I'm introducing the chazal, and that's the pshat in the chazal without any question, but let's just proceed anyways on investigating it ourselves. Okay, and then we'll see in the end we have to cope with the chazal, but let's try to understand. Back to the question. Okay, a person can answer the dilemma. A person would be able to say as follows. They could say, you've really shown me no proof that the mind can be subordinated to the emotion. First good idea, you've really shown me no proof that the mind can be subordinated to the emotion. I'll tell you why. Because the drunkard that realizes that drinking is no good doesn't realize that drinking is no good, why it's no good philosophically, in terms of his soul. He's not a philosopher. The only realization that he has is based on the instinctual, because he realizes that his instinctual life is going to be destroyed. He's not going to have a home, his wife, his kids, you know, his job, okay? That's going to be destroyed. So, and all those things are simply part of the instinctual makeup of man. So the reason why he realizes, he thinks that drunkenness is going to destroy him, is not because of any kind of deep philosophical insight. It's just, it's a simple thing that he's not going to be able to attain his pleasures. So the argument could be like this. He doesn't really have any knowledge of why drinking is no good. That's not true knowledge. That's just the fact that he's going to be missing his instinctual pleasure. Now when he has the bottle in front of him, and the desire is very powerful, so this instinctual desire, which is very close at hand, always exerts more power in a person than a future kind of satisfaction, because that's where the emotions work. It's like one philosopher said that every time a person commits a fault, a sin, he's basically suffering from nearsightedness. Because the pleasure that's very close by looks very big, and the pain in the distance looks very small. So that's the only problem he has. He has an ocular problem. So a person could argue that being the case, so then you're not giving me an example of knowledge against you're not giving me an example of real knowledge against emotion. That's not really true knowledge. If the person would have a philosophical knowledge, that would mean to say that he'd understand why the instinctual life is really not where his energy should be placed, and that his energy should be placed in a completely different area. And he'd understand why doing that, his existence is going to be on a different plane, and it's going to be a different kind of existence, qualitatively differentiated. He'd never have this problem. Because what he's doing, he's involved in the tug of war of one emotion against another. It's not true knowledge. A person could argue that point, and therefore they would say that you can never produce a case to show me that the emotions can overpower the mind. Let's say if a person does a chait, it's because he doesn't really understand what the chait is. He thinks he knows. He thinks, well, he thinks like this, a plain person, yeah, God told me not to do it, it's a chait, I'll get an avera, and I'll suffer in Gehenna for it, or maybe something will happen over a year, it might even be worse. Therefore, he's just operating on the instinctual level, instinctual plane. He's one thing, maybe I'll lose a lot of money, God says, maybe something will happen to me, to my health or whatever, some kind of fear. So that's, again, he's in the instinctual. But it's not because that's the lowest level, that's the person that's over in the era. But the higher level, where a person's over in the Ava, where he really understands that this is the life of man, and he looks down at the part of man which is involved in the emotions and the instinctual, that person wouldn't fall prey to this. In other words, you could say like this: what is the difference between the question was raised? What's the difference? What difference does that make? But the fact is, his mind is telling him it's not logical to do this. So you see, he's going against logic, right? Yeah, he's going against logic. But a person can still argue that it may be true that he's going against logic, but he's not going against knowledge. And it's only knowledge that really can control the soul. In other words, the only way the soul will be subordinated is through knowledge. And as long as it's not knowledge, then the soul is not moved. So it is true that it's not logical, but it's not the soul that's involved. You see, because the point is, what you're having here is a tug of war. So does the man know that drinking is no good? He doesn't really have any knowledge of why drinking is no good. So the soul, I could argue like this, that the soul is moved by knowledge. And as long as there's no knowledge, the soul is not involved. So therefore, this type of thinking, it's true, he knows it's no good in terms of taiva. But that type of argument doesn't impress the soul any, because the soul is only affected where it's knowledge, and this isn't knowledge. So that's why you could, as long as you don't have the element of soul involved, it's true, then the emotions can overpower. But the moment you've reached a soul, which means that you've attained true knowledge of why this is harmful, nothing can budge you from that knowledge.
What's the difference between logic and knowledge?
See, logic is just a consistency. It's just a consistency. But it's just a consistency within a certain framework. Knowledge means that you really know why this is no good. When the soul can really gain knowledge, nothing can separate the soul from that knowledge. And therefore, no matter how powerful the emotion, the soul will always remain rigidly fixed and embracing the knowledge. That's the argument that I would produce. So let me just to go over the argument again. If you could imagine a dialogue over here between the soul and the emotions, the soul would say, "Do I really know that it's not good to drink? I don't know it's not good to drink." The soul completely abandons its position. It has no position on this. So there's nothing to move it. So you haven't really shown me a good case. So you can argue another. You can argue another way. The only thing, this argument that I'm giving now, is only a breakdown of the... Well, it's not a breakdown, but it shows you that the common argument from the drunkard, you see, or the drug addict, is not a valid argument. There's another position you could take here. You could say it like this. You could say that I maintain that the only way for man to control his passions is and live a virtuous life is through knowledge. And you don't have to use my last argument. You could say, let's take the case of the drunkard. And let's say that's a case of knowledge against emotion. Let us say that was all. And you could still argue that the only way that man can attain his perfection is through knowledge. Because I could say like this, I could tell you like this, that let's say we assume that the drunkard has the knowledge that the drinking is no good. Not philosophical knowledge, but let's say it's enough knowledge. Yeah, practical level. But nevertheless, even though he's overpowered, at the moment before he decides to drink, but I would say the reason why he's overpowered is because of a lack of knowledge. What kind of knowledge? Not philosophical knowledge, but psychological knowledge. In other words, it's not that this person needs what they're trying to prove is, what the world is trying to prove with the argument for the drunkard, the classical argument, is that there's such a thing as willpower, and there's another kind of institution that we have to introduce in order for a person to attain perfection. And what I'm saying is no. I'm saying that there's no other force. The only force is intellect, reason. But in order for reason to work, there can't be any blind spots. Now, reason over here, let us say, it's adequate insofar as the recognition of the fact that drinking is foolish. But he has no knowledge of himself and why he's drawn to drink. But if he would have an understanding of his own emotional forces, then they wouldn't be able to exercise any power over him. So that one could maintain the argument that the drunk is overpowered and yet not require the introduction of any kind of outside element like willpower or any of these kind of ideas outside of knowledge. And they could say that willpower is nothing, it's nonsense, doesn't work, and the only thing that works is knowledge. But over here you haven't shown me a case of knowledge in terms of the person. You've only shown me a case of knowledge in terms of the activity. But the true remedy for the drunk is for him to understand why he is drawn to this type of activity. And once he'd attain a knowledge of that, then he'd be able to refrain from the drinking. Because I would say that in action there are two things. In action there are two things. In action there is the objective good. We have to know what the objective good is, and then we have to know how to apply ourselves to the objective good. But in order to apply yourself to the objective good, you have to know yourself. So you have to understand how your emotions work. If you understand how your emotions work and how you're being and why you're being driven by the emotion, you might be able to control the emotion through particular knowledge of the self. In other words, knowledge is really the only remedy. But knowledge being the remedy can't just be knowledge of abstract. It must be knowledge insofar as your function is concerned as well, because what's involved in performance is ideas, and also you, personally you. So as long as you don't have knowledge concerning how you function, so then you can't possibly do anything about it. But knowledge really would be able, knowledge about yourself would be able to prevent you from falling prey to the vice. Yes. In other words, the self is very much involved over here, the self. And because he doesn't understand the self is going to distort that result. The bad thing about being a drunk is not what people think. It's not because he's going to lose his family, he's going to lose his kids, he's going to lose his job. It's the fact that a real tzaddik has to know himself is an open chazal. And the chazal always say that a person must be aware of tachbulos hayetzer. That means that they had an intricate, that's part of the milchemes achayim. Chazal had an intricate knowledge of what was going on inside their minds. The Melchemes Achayim, with the Yetzer, against the Yetzer. So Chazal do not maintain that just philosophical knowledge alone is enough. I mean, that's certain. The argument for psychological knowledge is as follows. That a person is not, in this case of the drunkard, he's not being fooled by his mind in terms of his knowledge of drunkenness. But what he's being fooled by is his psychological urges. He has no way to control them. If he understood them, he'd be able to work with them, control them. The argument is, to put it succinctly, that an emotion could overpower the mind. But the mind can undermine an emotion. That's the point. An emotion that's not understood is not a fair case of mind against emotion. In order to give me a case of mind against emotion, you have to show me a case where the mind understands the emotion. A blind emotion can overpower the mind, but the mind has the ability to undermine the emotion through knowledge. Once it understands how the emotion works, then it's in control. That's the argument.
You're not saying that
So again, I was just repeating the question. The classical case of the drunkard
And the answer was that what we suggested was, we didn't prove it, but we suggested was that that's not really a case of the emotions being overpowered by the mind, by the emotions, but the mind being overpowered by the emotions. Because the, what's the problem over there? The mind doesn't really know it well. The mind only knows from a practical sense, not from a philosophical sense. The case would be, let's say philosophically, the drunkard would realize that the only purpose of the energy of man is for thought. So then he wouldn't have any problem abstaining, because he'd understand that this is really why this is so, and that this is the best life, and then he wouldn't have any problem with the with drinking. But the drunkard doesn't have such knowledge. At least we don't have drunkards, philosophical drunkards. We don't have an experiment to talk about. Okay, now, the other possibility says like this. We said that this isn't really a good case, the drunkard. Why? Because what you have over there is, it's not a case of the mind against the emotions, really. Because the mind over here is handicapped. See, the mind doesn't understand why he wants to drink. If the mind would understand why he wants to drink, if the knowledge of the mind was turned against the emotions itself, then he wouldn't have the problem. Okay? So what you're doing is, you're handicapping the mind. You're giving the mind half knowledge. But if he gave the mind full knowledge of why he drinks, then he wouldn't have any problem. That's the second argument. Okay? Of course, the second argument could be attacked. Because you could say, what difference does it make if he doesn't have knowledge of his emotions? But the fact is, he does have a piece of knowledge in his mind, and this piece of knowledge is being robbed, distorted. We explained that before he does it, that he always loses the knowledge somehow. Knowledge changes, because he can't act without knowledge. Man can't act without knowledge, so he always makes an exception. In this case, it's better for me to drink. He always loses that knowledge, that universal knowledge that he was very convinced about before, but suddenly knowledge changes. So we see the emotions, the way the emotions work is not that they actually obliterate the knowledge. I mean, they don't go against the knowledge, I should say. They distort they distort the truth, and they actually they don't destroy the knowledge directly, indirectly. He sort of loses his knowledge, amnesia. Okay? But you see nevertheless that what? That a piece of knowledge, the second argument, can argue down the idea that a piece of knowledge which exists in his brain is being overpowered. Whereas according to the first argument, you can still maintain that it can't be overpowered. I think what we have to do at this point is just to clarify what we've said up till now. Let's maneuver. Sometimes if you can't make any headway, it's because you don't have the clarity in what you have up to this point. Let's clarify what we have at this point. Let's take the argument about the philosophical. The argument about the philosophical is as follows. The reason why the mind is overpowered is because you don't have true philosophical knowledge. I mean, so what? Again, we'll ask the same question. So you're not true philosophical knowledge, but you have some kind of knowledge. So what kind of an answer is that? The answer is like this. The answer is the mind, what we call mind, let's call it mind. Mind functions in two different realms. Sometimes it functions in the service of the emotions and the instincts, and sometimes it functions on its own, in its own world, its own terms. Okay? It's a free agent, exactly. In most people's lives, the mind is merely used in the service of the instincts. Okay? If you didn't say that, you'd have to say a Russia is a very intellectual person. Because a Russia thinks out his plans. The answer is that those thinking of the plans has nothing to do with the soul, because it's completely dominated in the service of the instincts. But when we speak about the soul, we speak about the mind functioning on its own as a free agent. In other words, the mind is functioning on its own. That's a different kind of function in man. Different kind of function. It's a different, what it is really is a different dynamic. It's a different energy system. You understand what I mean? It's a different energy system. Now, as long as the driving force is the instinct, so then you can't speak really about mind. You don't have... Mind is only when we say the mind can't be overruled by the emotion, we're speaking about mind, the function of mind. the agency of the mind, and the mind as a separate agency. The mind as a functional agency is, as an institution, is only when the mind is operating with its own energies. It's operating on its own energies. It's a different functional entity. Whereas when a person uses his brain, that would be the difference between brain and mind in our definition. When a person uses his brain can be used in the service of the instincts. That's not really that's a different energy system that's functioning. So it's a different institution. Okay? That clarifies the difference. Yeah? In one case, the energy is flowing freely to the mind. And the mind is really the one that's determining where it goes, investigating different areas based upon its desire for truth. The energy is being used under the drive for truth and for knowledge, the quest for knowledge. That's a different type of energy system. Whereas over here, just because a person thinks that he's going to kill somebody, he's not using his mind. He's using his brain, which means to say that the intelligence that he's using is driven not by the mind, it's driven by the instinct. That's really the difference between a Rasha and a Tzaddik. A Rasha, you can't say a Rasha is stupid. A Rasha, your Rasha is unintelligent. No, a Rasha is very intelligent. But his intelligence is not really a function of the soul. It's a function of the instincts, which harnesses his intelligence. So the soul is not even functioning. The soul means the soul is a certain functional situation. It's not simply brain or intellect. It's a certain functional entity. Okay? That's really clarifying our point. So what we're saying is that if the mind can operate on its own terms, then it can't be overpowered. Only in the instinctual can it be overpowered. Of course, in the instinctual, you're dealing with the same type of thing. So one instinct gets stronger, it'll knock over. He has brain power there. Yeah, but the brain power is essentially what? It's essentially another. It's driven by the instinct. So the reason why it's overpowered is because it's not really mind. You understand? It really is instinctual. It's using intelligence, but that doesn't mean it's mind. It's not functioning as mind. It's in the same realm. So in the same realm, what is going to prevail? The more powerful emotion. So he's depressed and he has a bottle in front of him. That's it. That's the most powerful emotion at the moment. Nothing's going to stop him. Okay? So he's depressed and he has a bottle in front of him. That's it. That's the most powerful emotion at the moment. Nothing's going to stop him. Okay? I'm clarifying it more why there's good reason to assume that the mind cannot be overpowered. And the instance of a new definition of mind. Mind isn't merely intelligence, but mind is a functional entity. It's a functional entity in man, where the energy is being directed, is being used by man's desire for his free floating desire for truth. See, it's a different kind of an energy system. Different energy system. That system can't be overpowered. If the energy is in that system, can't be overpowered. But when the energy is basically in the instinctual, just because he's using intelligence, that doesn't mean that his mind. That's simply a mechanics of the brain. It's a mechanics of the brain. That's not gonna help him. Then it's just instinctual. So it's one instinct against the other, and that's why the more powerful instinct always wins. Explains the phenomenon. In other words, philosophical knowledge, what we're saying philosophical knowledge is not factual knowledge. Philosophical knowledge is a knowledge that stems from a certain kind of energy distribution. That's philosophical knowledge. It means the energy is in the philosophical. It's not a factual. It's not a factual knowledge. Some of them, well, this is no good because if as long as the person is essentially functioning instinctually, no piece of information can be said to be related to the soul. The only time the information can be related to the soul is where the soul is functioning on its own terms and in its own energy system. That is what we're calling mind. And that kind of mind, we say, is a good reason to believe, or we haven't seen at least, that it can be overpowered by the instincts. Then you have a real conflict between instinct and mind. Whereas if you just have a person that's functioning on the instinctual, and he has pieces of information, the pieces of information don't represent mind. That's just a tool, something the instinct uses.
So it's instinct against instinct. So the more powerful one will win. Okay? Now let's clarify the second argument. The second argument was that if the person's mind had true knowledge of how the emotions work, he wouldn't break down. Yeah, but the point is, okay, so we said, yeah, very nice, but still he has this piece of knowledge. Right? I'm forgetting about the last argument. Now, the question we have to ask is, why should that be so? Why should it be that this piece of knowledge can be overpowered, overruled? But once the soul gains more knowledge, the mind, whatever, gains more knowledge of the instinctual, then somehow or other it's capable of warding off the attack. Why? I mean, if mind can ward off the attack, so one piece of knowledge should be enough. And if it can't, so then what's it going to help if you have many pieces of knowledge? So the argument really, when you look at it again, looks like a ridiculous argument. The theory that explains this phenomena is that the instinctual process, the instinctual energy, as long as the person is unaware of what the instinct is really after, the instinct will always succeed. Why? Because it has to have an outlet. It has to have an outlet, and there's no way that you're going to stop it. Because it's a sum of energy that's seeking expression, and no matter what, it's just a practical thing that energy is going to have to be satisfied. Can't stop. Our question is, so what happens when you have knowledge? What happens when you have knowledge? So there's only one answer. When you have knowledge, the instinct has an outlet through the knowledge itself. Close to 100. You have an outlet through the knowledge itself. Meaning to say that a person, when he knows what the instinct is after, that itself is the outlet. He doesn't need to do the action. He could stop right there. But if he doesn't know what it is, the energy is going to push forward and cause him to do certain actions. Because he has no knowledge, he has no way to vent the energy. There's no way to vent it. And since there's no way to vent that energy, so it's going to have to be vented through action. But if he knows it, so then he can vent the energy. It's vented through the mind. Okay? Which is basically what the whole Torah tells us. Torah doesn't tell us what to think. You think, you can't control your thoughts. But what the Torah says is that the person, after thoughts come into his mind, he has to make a decision. The over avera is really the one that does the performance. The performance is over there, not the thoughts. Thoughts is even machshava roa in a kaddish baruch mitzvah alamaisa. I mean, the person even plans to kill somebody. That's even more. That's more advanced. I mean, that's not a good thing. It's machshava roa. The person thinks he wants to kill somebody. That's not his fault. But if that thought should put into process a whole system of attack, a plan, that's already machshava roa. But even that stage, we say, ain't a kaddish baruch hu mitzvah l'maaseh, and as long as he refrains from the action, so he's not considered an avayan. Okay? Yeah, only by a Jew. Very dangerous when goyim get thoughts. Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is that the sum of energy needs some kind of venting in the person, and the fact that he knows what it's after is already enough of a vent. I'm saying is like this: if a person wants to kill his friend but doesn't know it, his friend is in serious danger. If he knows he wants to kill him, then his friend is okay, because through the faculty of imagination or some kind of process, the moment the person's aware of it, so that itself vents the energy and it's free. It's free now. But if it can't reach the mental apparatus, then it's not free, and it has to express itself, so it's going to express itself in action. And really, when the person is a drunkard, he doesn't know why he's drinking, which means to say he's drinking for some reason, he's trying to gain some satisfaction, which he's completely unaware of, and he has no way of venting the satisfaction. So the drinking is the only situation that's going to allow him to vent this desire, okay, which is what we're positing is that a person doesn't drink for drinking's sake. That's what we're saying. Not everybody. I mean, not everybody. We're saying a certain kind of a person. The Gemara Yevamos that says Uhuri Aver Kashim Me'Avera means that it's worse in the sense that a person is degrading the faculty that God gave him for the higher sphere, and he's using it for the lower sphere. Yeah. So therefore, he's it's even worse because he's channeling valuable energy, which is the mental energy that could be used for the higher expression. He's channeling into the lower, whereas the affair itself is just a maisa. A maisa is only the physical. But the other Gemara is not in contradiction. The other Gemara is just saying it's not considered as if he did it. It's two different frameworks. It's two different frameworks. And maisa, it's not considered maisa. But philosophically, it's detrimental. Yeah, it's a different type of corruption. Two different corruptions. There's a corruption of action itself. Action itself corrupts the person. It's a good question. Yes, this question is a good question. Those two Gemaras. How do you reconcile those two Gemaras? The answer is it's two different corruptions. I'm not explaining it really. I mean, it's something to think into. Okay. Yeah. According to this answer, the drunkard could be stopped by what? Just a psychological. So now we've really, in essence, according to the last argument, I mean, what turns out is we've lost our experiment. Because the experimental case, we could say, the experimental case where we see that man submits to his emotions is what? Is only where we could say all those cases that we could think of is because the man doesn't have any real knowledge. Psychological knowledge. Had he had psychological knowledge, he would never be forced to submit. There's one point we have to make. The point is as follows, that in the way we explain the second to last argument, another point comes up. Namely, that if that theory is correct, then we should be able to posit that a person can overcome the emotion through the philosophical. Through the philosophical. Why? Because the way the person succumbs to the drunkenness is because the energy requires an outlet, correct? But if the energy were channeled off into the area of the mind, then he wouldn't require any outlet. Since it's based on an energy system, so if the energy was channeled off into the area of the mind, so then he would bypass the process necessary in order to allow him to control the emotion, right? That's why, I mean, a psychological fact is that many times intellectuals are saved from neuroses because they could channel off a lot of energy into thought process. So we lost our case because of two reasons, but the question still remains. Now the question remains, what if a person is overpowered by two forces simultaneously, the mind and the emotions? His mind tells him one thing and the emotions tell him something else. Can the emotions overpower the mind? That's the question. We lost the experimental case, right? What's the answer? The answer depends on one thing. What does the answer depend on? What? Depends on free will. That's what it is. Bechira chafshis. That's what it depends on. Because if you're going to say that the mind can never be overpowered by the emotions, there's no bechira. That's what he's saying, basically. He's saying there's no bechira. He's saying once the person has the knowledge, then no matter how powerful the emotions, he has to follow his knowledge. That means basically that there's no bechira. Okay? If you say the other way, that the emotions will overpower the mind, can overpower the mind, again you're saying that what? That there's no Bechira. You're saying there's no Bechira. Yadus holds that neither one of these is true. Because Yadus posits that a person has free will. What does free will mean? Free will does not mean that a person, if he goes past the store and he decides to get a hot dog and then he changes his mind and says, no, I'm going to get a drink of water, no, I think I'll have a soda, no, I think I'll have this. This is not free will. This is not expression of free will. This is just a tug of war of emotions. It depends which emotion is more powerful.
Should I go to work? Should I stay home? So first he decides to go to work. He goes outside, it's raining, he goes back into the house. No, I think I'll stay home. Stays home, now has nothing to do with it, now go to work. All this is not decisions. These are just a tug of war between emotions, and the most powerful emotion in the moment is going to win. That's it. That's not Bechira. What is Bechira? Bechira is where the mind, the philosophical mind, sees clearly what the reality is telling him. And the emotional tug is still there. Because the mind cannot remove the tug, unless the person's involved completely, his energies. But we're not talking about a person that's involved in the process of thinking, right? Because then there's no problem. But we're saying that he has the knowledge of the mind's free activity. He has the knowledge of the mind's free activity, but simultaneously, he has the pull of the emotions, the draw of the emotions. Okay? So what happens is like this. What we say is what happens is like this. That there is a soul, the soul of man, which could be attracted, is attracted to both of these in two different ways. In the one way, when it sees the world of ideas and the world of reality, the world of the soul, it's attracted there. That seems correct. On the other hand, when it sees the world of the emotions, it's attracted to that as well. Correct? And we say that man is capable of determining, that's what free will means, of determining. There are two wheels spinning. One wheel is the wheel of the philosophical reality. His mind is satisfied and sees that this is the correct idea. Okay? The other world is the world of the instinctual. And the person is in between and he sees both worlds working, operating before his eyes, before his mind's eye. Now, he's drawn to both. He's drawn to both, but in different ways. The soul, you could say equally. Equally. He's drawn to both equally. But the soul must determine which one it's going to follow. That's Bechira Chofshis. That's free will. The soul must determine which one it's going to follow. And based upon that determination, the outcome rests. Okay? So if that's the case, so then the Yadus has a separate, a very specific solution for the ancient philosophical problem of can the mind be raped by the emotions? The answer is, if you say yes or no, you're wrong. Because in either case, you're denying Bechira Chofshis. Yadus maintains there's such a thing as Bechira Chofshis. Now we understand what Yosef HaTzadik did. Because Yosef HaTzadik, yes, there's Bechira Chofshis. There is Bechira Chofshis. But a part of Bechira Chofshis is that a person that's attracted to the world of the mind, it's actually the case of Yosef presents a problem. Why? Because we said he resolved this problem through rationality. It was not just self-control, it was rational control, but rational control based upon the desire that he was involved in, but not based upon the philosophical and abstract. So it would seem that if it was just the philosophical and abstract and the emotion, he would have fallen prey. So the problem is that where is the Bechira Chofshis? Yeah, the truth of the matter is that's right. But the story of Yosef HaTzadik is unique because really he failed in his Bechira. That means he made a decision and he failed. But in the last moment he retrieved himself, he saved himself how? Through a different kind of argument based upon the emotion itself. It means it was a rational element. He used his mind to show that the emotion itself is in contradiction. So is there Bechira involved in what Yosef did? You have to say there's Bechira involved in what Yosef did, because you see that he's considered one of the greatest tzaddikim because of that. So what does it mean? It means to say that his Bechira was that that's also a rational element. His Bechira was to attach himself to that rationality or to simply go by the instinct of the moment. So since he attached himself to that rationality, he exercises Bechira on that secondary level, and that's why he wasn't tzaddik. That's right. So you see, that's right. Any rational, the attachment to a rational system, even within the framework of the emotion, is an exercise of Bechira. So you'll tell me, so that's not Bechira because he's using his emotions and he's using his mind in the service of his emotions. He's using his mind in the service of his emotions. Now the answer is like this. The answer is he wasn't using his mind in the service of the emotions. He wasn't saying that his desire to be on the Ephod was greater than his desire for her. That's not what he was saying. That's not what he's saying. If that was the case, it wouldn't be Bechira. What it means is like this. It means he didn't lose the philosophical knowledge. Exactly. The philosophical knowledge was there. And he supported it with the rationale of the destruction that results intrinsically from Avera. That is not, that's the mind. That is the mind function. That's the mind function.
What?
Exactly. The mind if the mind supports the philosophical conclusion, the philosophical conclusion was it's wrong. But he couldn't, he failed. But then he saw further that this philosophical conclusion is supported by the fact that one who follows the emotions is going to be totally destroyed. That is an extension of the philosophical. That's not considered, that's not the mind in the service of the emotions. That's really the mind utilizing the emotions in the service of reason. That's why it's considered an exercise of Bechira. If it would have been just a desire to be on the Ephod is greater than this, that wasn't. No, because desires for the Ephod don't seem so great when a person is in such a kind of a situation. Like Geis Vatzar. It means that he was able to remove himself from the emotion and allow and then show, demonstrate that the emotion itself is a tarted asasri and self-destructive force. And therefore he was able to really return to what? To the philosophical. But he needed, he required that point in order to give more fuel to the side of the philosophical. You see, Yosef may not represent the ultimate in terms of how to conquer the emotion, because the ultimate is really through the knowledge itself. But it's the ultimate in terms of the dynamics of the situation. In such a situation, for a person to be able to do something like that, against such a force and a power, that is godless Adam. So it's not the mind in the service of the emotion. It's the mind in the service of the philosophical. That was what really. If Yosef HaTzadik didn't have the philosophical, that little thought would never mean a thing.